KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If you are here on a visa, absolutely, that is a privilege, not a right.
An official at the Department of Homeland Security tells NPR due process looks different for alleged terrorists. For Sunday, April 6th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid, coming up, an interview with the president of Princeton University. His school joins a growing list of colleges facing funding cuts under the Trump administration.
So one of the things that I'm especially worried about is a disruption of that talent pipeline that has been so important to the United States' leadership in the world.
And a conversation with the playwright Larissa Fasthorse about her new show that examines cultural flashpoints through comedy.
Using this format of satire and farce, one just makes it fun, makes it palatable, makes it interesting, but also does allow me to open up the absurdity of what we're dealing with.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump's widespread tariffs on most imported products from most countries that went into effect this weekend have rattled Wall Street and world markets. And today, many of his cabinet members went on Sunday talk shows to defend their boss. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins tells CNN the 50 countries want to negotiate their tariffs with Trump. But consumers are worried about the threat of a recession, which some economists say is now possible this year. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, though, doesn't agree.
I think we could see from the jobs number on Friday that was well above expectations that, you know, we are moving forward. So I see no reason that we have to price in a recession.
Speaking there on NBC's Meet the Press. Vietnam is asking President Trump to delay the implementation of sky-high tariffs that he announced last week. NPR's John Ruich reports the government of the Southeast Asian country wants to negotiate, and it's dangling the prospect of zero tariffs on U.S. imports.
Vietnamese Deputy Prime Minister Bùi Thanh Sơn met the U.S. ambassador on Sunday. Sơn proposed that Trump hold off on implementing the tariffs on Vietnam in order to create an environment conducive to negotiations. In his tariff blitz last week, Trump hit Vietnam with a 46% levy. That's among the highest of any country. It's due to take effect on Wednesday. Sơn said the U.S. tariffs are not consistent with the reality of bilateral economic and trade cooperation, which has been booming. He said Vietnam is ready to negotiate and even reduce its tariffs on U.S. goods to zero. Vietnam is among the earliest countries seeking negotiations, which could be a test of Trump's willingness to haggle over his protectionist trade agenda. John Ruich, NPR News, Beijing.
Around the country, hundreds of affordable housing renovations are at risk after the Trump administration froze a billion-dollar program. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports the goal was to make older places more livable and energy efficient.
In Emporia, Virginia, Trinity Woods Senior Living desperately needs new central air conditioning. Their old system died 3 years ago. Resident Dina Moore says summers are too hot, even for bingo nights.
Last year, it was god-awful.
The Department of Housing and Urban Development had awarded them and hundreds of other places money for an upgrade, potentially including solar panels. But now HUD says energy efficiency does not fit its mission. Julia Gordon oversaw the HUD program under President Biden and says it would help private industry that's providing badly needed affordable housing.
This is how government works at its best.
Legal challenges allege that freezing this congressionally approved funding is unlawful. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News.
U.S. futures contracts are lower. Dow futures down about 3.5%. You're listening to NPR News. In West Texas, a second child has died from measles. The hospital treating the young girl says she was unvaccinated. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said on social media today that he's in West Texas visiting the children's families. Kennedy, a vaccine skeptic, says he sent the CDC there last month to help the state with vaccines, saying on X that the MMR vaccine is the most effective way to prevent the spread of measles. Health officials there say there are more than 600 cases of measles around the country since the outbreak began in late January. Well, for the first time this year, Hollywood has a blockbuster. And as NPR's Bob Mondello reports, it actually looks like a block.
Minecraft the Movie is a kid's flick inspired by a video game.
Anything you can imagine is possible. As long as what you imagine can be built out of blocks.
Reviews were mixed, and estimates suggested an opening weekend of around $55 million, but Minecraft topped that on its opening day.
This place makes no sense.
It will close out the weekend with about $157 million in North America alone. That's almost double this year's previous biggest opening, and it's the highest opening ever for a movie based on a video game. Minecraft is doing nearly as well overseas. Its worldwide ticket sales after 3 days total more than $300 million. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
In U.S. futures contracts on Wall Street, Dow futures are down about 3.5%. NASDAQ futures are down 4.8%. S&P 500 futures are down nearly 4%. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. Just hours after his inauguration in January, President Trump began to fulfill his campaign promise to expand the number and scope of deportations of immigrants who come to the United States illegally. At the center of one case is a man from Maryland. His name is Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia. He was deported last month to a prison in El Salvador in what a federal judge now says was a grievous error, because an immigration judge had already ruled he could not be deported to El Salvador because he might face torture in his home country. But the Trump administration insists he should stay there. With us now to talk about the Trump administration's immigration policy is Tricia McLaughlin, Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security. Tricia, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin by asking you why the administration asked for a stay to the order to return Abrego Garcia when he was deported in error. The judge said that the administration has not shown, quote, any evidence of gang membership.
Well, that actually is just not true. An immigration judge reviewed evidence and determined he actually is a verified member of MS-13. There's also intelligence reports that he's involved in human trafficking. So I think the bottom line for the American people and for those who are listening today is that this individual in question, who's an MS-13 gang member, he should be behind bars, whether it be in El Salvador or in a U.S. detention facility. He should not be on the streets of America. And to remind listeners, MS-13 is a gang that murders, rapes, traffics drugs. They maim for sport. These are individuals we do not want in our country, especially those who are here illegally.
Tricia, I know you all are saying that he is a member of MS-13. To be clear, the judge has seen no evidence of that. His lawyers also deny this. Will you all be releasing any evidence to the public supporting this claim?
Well, every time that a gang member denies being a gang member doesn't mean we're going to share intelligence reports that undermine our national security. But I do have to correct the record there, because there's been multiple immigration judges who have reviewed evidence that he's an MS-13 member and confirmed doing so, including the DOJ's immigration appeals. They affirmed his dangerousness and dismissed his appeal.
Beyond the specifics of this one case, just given the sheer numbers of deportations that we are seeing without hearings under this administration, do foreigners living in the United States have the right to due process, to a court process?
Absolutely. In every single case, there is due process. When you're looking at members of MS-13 and Tren de Aragua and other terrorist organizations that were designated as terrorist organizations under President Trump and the Trump administration, their due process does look different because you're under terrorist authority. So it's going to be more law enforcement sensitive. But I can guarantee, and our DOJ guarantees due process to these individuals.
So, Tricia, you're saying that the cases that we have seen of people being put into detention facilities, or in some cases flown to a foreign country without any hearing, that there's due process? Because it doesn't look to the public like we've seen any indication of due process or court process.
There is due process. It's more difficult to get into specifics when you're looking at national security issues, especially with terrorist individuals.
Can you give us any indication of what that due process looks like?
Again, it's law enforcement sensitive, and to give out intelligence reports just because these individuals are denying being members of these vicious gangs would undermine national security. If we did that every single time, that would simply be insane.
So it sounds like in these cases, it's the government's word, though, against, say, a lawyer's word or against an individual's word, and there's no ability for any sort of recourse?
Oh, I completely disagree with that. I mean, we've had multiple instances, actually, with the individual in question that you were mentioning earlier, the Maryland MS-13 gang member, where multiple immigration judges reviewed evidence and determined that he is a verified member of MS-13. That wasn't one judge, that wasn't two judges, that was multiple judges and a appeals board. So I would actually just completely disagree with you. There's been multiple reviews in process, not just by lawyers, not just by the government, but by these immigration judges themselves.
I want to ask you about students we have seen detained, in some cases now facing deportation. The White House and DHS have asserted that these students were supporting terrorism. They say that they were exercising their free speech rights, criticizing Israel's war in Gaza. Can you articulate what sort of evidence you all have that support the claims of ties to terrorism?
Absolutely. I mean, some of this looks like defacing property. Some of this is holding buildings hostage, making threats against other students, especially harassing Jewish students.
But defacing property is not considered a terrorism charge, according to my understanding, and broad.
Of course not. But these individuals are here on visas, and visas are a privilege, not a right.
So there's a different set of rules, you're saying, for foreigners living in the U.S.?
If you are here on a visa, absolutely. There is that is a privilege, not a right. And the Secretary of State maintains the authority to revoke that visa. And if that's the case, then ICE and DHS will enforce it.
Tricia, I do want to shift gears and ask you briefly about the CPB Home app and the effort to have people self-deport. How is the administration tracking people who may want to self-deport, who may want to voluntarily leave the United States in this moment?
Absolutely. There's a great app called CBP Home. It's a free app on all devices. And those who are here in the country illegally have the opportunity to self-deport, putting in some basic identifying information, and then indicate on the app that they have left the country. This is going to put them in a much better position. If they leave now, they don't have to be arrested, they don't have to be detained, and they could potentially come back to the country legally the right way and come and live the American dream. I think it's a really great tool that the Trump administration has given to these individuals.
How many people have thus far used this app, and where have you seen them go to?
North of 5,000. So we are tracking this each and every day. And again, this just gives folks a really good option that they don't have to deal with ICE. And this is a safer option for both law enforcement, but also for these aliens who are in the country.
Are you seeing a predominant sort of country of origin, or where are you seeing people go to?
I can't get into specifics just yet, but we will surely give NPR that information as soon as we have geographically where people are going.
The president has spoken about having the largest deportation in American history, and mass deportations are going to cost a lot of money. What is the strategy here if Congress does not give you the money that you all think you need to carry this out?
Well, you're right. It is expensive because the immigration crisis that was manufactured the last 4 years has caused this very expensive crisis. But I think an option that we've just spoke to actually earlier is that self-deportation. It's very inexpensive, especially if people take that option to leave now and potentially come back to live the American dream. So we're going to keep on encouraging that, and we're going to keep on messaging
to
it.
But that is really, Tricia, a fraction of the overall population in the country who, you know, is not here under a legal framework. So you're really looking at sort of a fraction of the overall population that has thus far used that app.
Well, sure, and we need to keep on incentivizing that because, again, not only is it less expensive for the American taxpayer, but it is safer. It is far safer for these migrants in our country, and it's far safer for law enforcement. We don't want to have to be in the position where people are being arrested and detained, but if they're in this country illegally and they don't leave now, that's what we're forced to do.
Tricia McLaughlin is the Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thousands of supporters of France's far-right National Rally Party gathered in Paris today to protest a court ruling barring their leader, Marine Le Pen, from running in the 2027 presidential election. Last week, Le Pen was convicted of embezzling millions of dollars in EU funds and using that money to finance her political party. A French judge banned her from public office for 5 years. NPR's Rebecca Rossman reports.
Mes amis.
Standing defiantly in front of the Place Vauban, the newly convicted presidential hopeful Marine Le Pen had a clear message for her supporters.
Et que chacun soit rassuré, je ne lâcherai rien.
I'm not giving up, Le Pen shouted. In return, a crowd estimated by police at 7,000 roared back in applause that turned into chants of Marine, Présidente. Le Pen is a three-time presidential candidate. At the rally, she accused the Paris court of making a political decision, not a judicial one. Her supporters, like 18-year-old Julien Roux, are enraged. He insists the ruling is not just about her, but about the future of France's democracy.
The far-right candidates at the presidential election is actually banned from the election, and I think it's not good, it's not equal to everyone.
Le Pen's allies, such as 29-year-old Jordan Bardella, her protege, as well as the president of her National Rally Party, have framed the court ruling as part of a larger political agenda, an attempt to silence their movement. Given the ruling, people are talking about Bardella to replace Le Pen, though his youth and lack of high-level political experience have raised doubts among some. Still, a new survey published on Sunday showed that in a hypothetical first-round vote, Le Pen or Bardella would each score around 32% to 36%, well ahead of potential rivals. Some analysts have suggested that Le Pen's conviction has only boosted her movement by turning her into a victim. But not so fast, says Pierre Moreau Chevrolet, who teaches at Sciences Po University.
The vast majority of the French people is rejecting that position of the Rassemblement National as a victim because they firmly believe, and they have been thinking that for a long period of time now, that politicians should be held accountable whenever they do wrong.
Patrick Mahay is in his early 70s. He tells me he came to watch Le Pen's speech out of curiosity. And out of fear.
On va dire qu'il y a quand même l'extrême droite qui arrive un petit peu partout.
The extreme right seems to be popping up again everywhere, he says. It reminds him of a part of history he thought had been left behind. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. A second child has died from the measles outbreak in West Texas. Health officials say there have been more than 600 cases reported around the country since the outbreak started in January. Heavy rains and flooding across parts of the Midwest and South over the weekend have left at least 18 people dead as floodwaters continue to rise. The National Weather Service has issued flood advisories for parts of several states today in the Southeast. And the Yukon Huskies are the winners of this year's NCAA Women's College Basketball Championship, beating South Carolina today 82-59. This is UConn women's 12th win, topping the legendary UCLA men's program that's won 11. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. President Trump has made deportation a top priority of his administration, delivering on a promise he made on the campaign trail.
On day one, I will launch the largest deportation program in American history.
During this campaign speech, Trump railed against immigrants who come to the United States illegally, whom he described as criminals and gang members.
We will not be occupied. We will not be overrun. We will not be conquered.
In March, the administration went further and invoked the Alien Enemies Act for the first time since World War II, this time to target alleged members of the Trenda Aragua gang.
You ought to be under arrest. So turn around.
The same month, federal immigration agents also began arresting people involved with pro-Palestinian activism on college campuses. One of them was Mahmoud Khalil, a graduate student and green card holder. His wife, Noor Abdullah, filmed his arrest as agents who refused to give their names handcuffed him and put him in an unmarked car.
Yeah, they just handcuffed him and took him. I don't know what to do.
Abdullah told NPR it took 38 hours for her to find out where her husband had been sent.
I think that's probably the most terrifying thing that has ever happened to me.
Deportation in the United States usually involves a long, complicated process. But as the Trump administration expands the number and scope of deportations, immigrant rights advocates are raising worries about due process and First Amendment rights. We're going to unpack the process of deportation now to understand it a bit better and discuss what it looks like in practice with NPR's Ximena Bustillo. She covers immigration policy for the network. Hey there.
Hi, Asma.
So you have been reporting on immigration for the last several months, and you've boiled down this deportation process into a number of different steps to help us understand how, I would say, a somewhat wonky process works. So what did you find?
I've identified this process down to five steps.
Okay.
Being identified as deportable, being arrested, going through immigration court, receiving a final order of removal, and ultimate removal. Keep in mind that process is individualized to each case, and who, what, when, where, how someone is identified can drag on for years or be very quick.
Got it. So let's start with the first step you just mentioned. What does it mean to be identified as deportable?
Those at risk for arrest primarily include people without legal status because they may have entered the country illegally, overstayed a work or student visa, or violated the terms of their green card, including by committing a crime. But the government doesn't have to prove that you committed a crime to see you as removable. A good example of this could be those without work authorization. There's about 8 million in this country.
So, Ximena, once someone is identified, then how does the government find them?
Homeland Security investigations are expensive and time-consuming, so they often rely on local law enforcement to report that they have arrested or identified someone without legal status. Then there's also what are called, quote, at-large arrests. These are arrests conducted by ICE out in the field.
Okay, so Ximena, from there, you enter into a court system, and I want you to help us understand how immigration courts differ than other courts in our American legal system.
So to start, they're not in the judicial branch like all other courts in our legal system. They're housed within the executive under the Department of Justice. And those arrested do not get the right to a lawyer, but they can ask to find one. And they do get the chance to make their defense. During the setting, there's also an attorney on behalf of ICE who argues in favor of removal. And then this is where things get more complicated. Immigration courts are currently backlogged about 4 million cases. And people are being arrested faster than the courts can process their cases.
I have a question here, though, Ximena. I mean, it seems like this court process you are describing is not actually what we have seen unfold with some of the high-profile cases that we've been hearing about since President Trump took office.
Right. So that's what a lot of immigration advocates are filing lawsuits over. They say that this court process had been completely sidestepped as people were put on planes and taken to other countries.
So how do they do that, though? How can you actually just sidestep the process?
The Trump administration is trying to use very specific authorities that they get access to expedite these removals. Some has been the use of the Alien Enemies Act, which specifically allows the administration to bypass the court process, as well as something called expedited removal, which, again, allows you to expedite the removal, skipping the court process.
I see. Okay, so let's get back to the process that you were describing, and I want to ask you about the final two steps. Say you potentially get a final removal order, and then you are removed. How does that actually happen? How does that work?
So there are roughly three main ways that people are removed. Either expedited removal, which I just explained. Uh-huh. That also primarily happens at the border, where people are basically taken back across. Then there's voluntary return, which is when someone makes their own travel arrangements. And then there's non-voluntary, which is when ICE arranges to fly you back. But there are challenges to sending many people back to their home countries. One reason is that their home countries have not agreed to accept them back. Mm-hmm. One thing I do not specifically list is the step of detention. Some people might be detained from the point that they're arrested all the way until a court decision is made or they're put on a removal flight. There's also alternatives to detention, such as wearing an ankle monitor or having regular check-ins with the government.
Okay. So, Jimena, what you have described seems like an incredibly lengthy process, perhaps a rather costly process as well. And yet it is something that President Trump campaigned on. He promised to bring about the largest deportation in American history. So how is what he promised during the campaign actually unfolding in these first few months?
There continues to be a big focus on deportations and arrests, but there is still a resource issue. Border Czar Tom Homan has been critical of Congress's slower pace in providing DHS with more money or codifying any of Trump's executive orders, especially as immigration policy does come more out of the White House instead of Congress, which is the body that makes laws and provides the funding.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your reporting.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Jimena Bustillo. In the span of just a few months, the Trump administration has rapidly redrawn the landscape for arts and culture in the United States. It has canceled millions of dollars in previously awarded grants to museums and libraries. It has attacked the Smithsonian Institution, saying in an executive order it has, quote, come under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology. And President Trump purged the board of the Kennedy Center here in Washington and replaced it with loyalists who, in an unprecedented move, elected him as the new chair. To make sense of this moment, we've called up Jane Alexander, the Emmy and Tony Award-winning actor, chaired the National Endowment for the Arts in the mid-1990s. Now, to be clear, the NEA has not seen cuts like other arts institutions, but as a lifelong advocate of the arts, we wanted to talk with Jane Alexander about what she sees as the broader importance of arts funding across the country. Jane Alexander, welcome to All Things Considered.
Oh, thank you, Asma. Happy to be here.
So at the outset here, I should note that NPR has received financial support from the National Endowment for the Arts. You know, I just outlined, Jane, a few of the many cuts, though, that the Trump administration has made to arts programs and cultural agencies. I want to ask, what has been your initial reaction to these changes that we have been seeing the last couple of months?
I'm not surprised that it has happened under this administration. I think they were looking at absolutely everything. I'm appalled. I don't think it's a wise decision, particularly since the arts are really for everyone, and we know that people love the arts in their community. So I don't think it's wise, but it's here and we have to challenge it.
In your time leading the NEA, you toured the nation examining the impact of that endowment's work. Can you give us a better sense of the sorts of things these federal arts grants support in local communities?
Oh, sure. The thing we have to remember is the endowment was founded to decentralize the commercial arts centers of the United States and bring the arts across the country to areas that did not have real accessibility to it. It was a noble dream, and it came to fruition in 1965 under Lyndon Johnson, and it's been extremely successful. I mean, just to give an example of theaters, there was a handful of professional theaters, and I include places like the Cleveland Playhouse that had been going a long time. And now there are, in almost every community of over 50,000 people, there is a professional theater. So that's extreme wonderful growth, and it allows the community to really participate.
Jane, you chaired the NEA in the 1990s, and you all did face some budget cuts during that time. Does what's happening today resemble the sorts of challenges you encountered back then?
Absolutely, yes.
Any lessons learned?
Yes, there are a lot of lessons learned, but there's some things that have happened that make it difficult to move forward in many respects. That's the lack of bipartisanship in the House and the Senate to some degree too. You know, if you can't get the votes from both sides of the aisles, because we're talking about all people represented in America, then you have a problem moving forward. It's going to be a challenge, but I think the case can be made because, as I said, people want the arts in their district. They want it. I traveled to all the states, the districts, 200 cities and towns in 1 year, and I saw a plethora of arts everywhere. My favorite place that I remember in my travels was, I couldn't even drive to it. The area was so rural, in a mining town way up in the hills of West Virginia. And I came in a helicopter and came out of the helicopter, and in this extraordinary field of flowers in June were all these young people dressed in costumes, and they were part of the Hartwood Dance Company that was funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. And my heart stopped. I felt like something out of Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream as they walked me through these flowers and we went to watch them dance. So this was the kind of thing that the NEA was seeding all across America, and it has been seeding since 1965.
Jane, I want to ask you about what the Trump administration is arguing in this moment. They hold that they are restoring, quote, truth and sanity to American history. We have heard the press secretary call programming at the Kennedy Center, for example, woke. They feel that broadly cultural institutions in this country at this moment have had a liberal bent, and that they have long had a liberal bent. Was that your experience?
Well, there's no such thing as a liberal or conservative bent, really, when you think about the arts. I mean, how do you talk about a painting that you might paint of trees? And, you know, there's no such thing. So are there things that are unacceptable to some people or they don't like? Absolutely. The arts are always going to be controversial in one way or another because people have likes and they have dislikes.
Jane, I have one final question for you here. Why should the government fund the arts? You mentioned that the United States only started doing this in the mid-60s with funding the National Endowment of the Arts. Some folks would question why the government ought to do this.
I'll tell you why, because the child's mind is the wealth of the nation. And if children don't grow up with any kind of cultural arts in their life, they are not going to know the expanse of the universe and everything that they can bring to it in and of themselves, even as an artist or as a participant in the arts. That, by that I mean an audience member. But everybody has a creative bent. Everybody has a creative spirit. Everybody wants to be part of it. All you have to do is look at television. How much of that is politics and news, and how much of that is of an artistic or sports events? And you see that the people want to take part. They want to see.
Jane Alexander is an actor and the former chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Asma.
We'll be right back. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A federal program that helps people pay their heating and cooling bills is now on hold. That's after its entire staff was fired this week. Alejandra Baranda from NPR's Climate Desk is here to talk about the potential fallout. Alejandra, hello.
Hi, Asma.
So this program, it's called the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, also known as LIHEAP. My understanding is that it has been around for years. What exactly does it do?
It's a great question. So its main goal is to help people pay utility bills so they can keep the heat on during winter and cooling on during summer. And like you said, it has a really long history. So during the energy crisis of the 1970s, energy prices skyrocketed. And they got so expensive that a lot of people ended up needing help with their heating bills. So the government stepped in. It created an early version of LIHEAP, and over the decades, its successor has become a lifeline. Here's energy expert Diana Hernandez from Columbia University.
So LIHEAP is the primary energy assistance safety net benefit in the United States. It serves millions of households every year that are facing a utility disconnection.
The program sends about $4 billion of LIHEAP money to the states and territories and tribes, and they distribute it to the people who need help.
So tell us more about what happened to the LIHEAP program this week.
Yeah, so roughly 24 staffers, or the entire office, was fired in the Trump administration's cuts at the Department of Health and Human Services, which is where LIHEAP was housed. Mm-hmm. Vicki Partlow was one of the staffers who was let go, and she says such deep staff cuts mean the program itself has essentially been gutted.
I don't really see how it can move forward without us as a federal kind of liaison.
She and her colleagues had already pushed out most of the funds for the 2025 fiscal year, but there's still about $400 million in play. And she says without the staff, that money is basically locked up.
Hmm. What does that mean in practical terms then for people trying to pay their energy bills? I mean, is this program dead?
Yeah, that's the real question right now. Partlow and Hernandez say this will directly affect people in need. And the immediate concern is for the upcoming summer, where people are going to need help to keep their ACs going.
Well, we know what happens. People don't have access to summer cooling. They won't turn it on. They're afraid of the bill, and for good reason. Last summer was the highest cost of summer cooling on record.
That's Mark Wolf. He runs the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, which works closely with the LIHEAP program. And he says, we know that people die or have big health consequences when they don't use their ACs. And then, of course, the real concern is next winter, too, because most of LIHEAP funds go to warming.
If people are not able to get assistance through this federal program, are there other ways that they could essentially keep the electricity running?
Yeah, that's another big question. Sonia Carley is an energy justice expert at the University of Pennsylvania, and she said this is a moment when states really need to step up.
So I think this is a really important time for states to reevaluate the protections that they have in place. And by protections, I mean when a state tells the utility companies you cannot disconnect somebody.
And look, a lot of experts say LIHEAP needed some reform, but they also say what happened this week isn't reform, and gutting the program is going to put people in real danger.
Alejandra Baranda from NPR's Climate Desk, thank you so much for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Yeah, great talking with you.
A spokesperson for HHS said that the department will continue to fulfill its legal obligations to run LIHEAP, though they did not specify how that would happen. And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
How free is America's free speech? We're asking Americans across the country about a constitutional guarantee. Many wanted us to obscure their names.
I'm definitely worried about getting reported.
Others are louder and bolder than ever. We begin a week-long series on the state of the First Amendment in the United States on the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Janine Herbst with these headlines. As countries around the world try to deal with President Trump's 10% tariffs on most goods that the U.S. imports, which took effect this weekend, some countries are trying to work out a deal, and that includes Vietnam, which is asking Trump to delay the tariffs, saying it wants to negotiate. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the Trump administration is revoking all visas issued to South Sudanese passport holders. Rubio cited South Sudan's failure to accept the return of its citizens, who have been removed from the U.S. And Washington Capitals' Alex Ovechkin broke Wayne Gretzky's record for the most goals in NHL history by scoring the 895th of his career. It happened in a game against the New York Islanders today. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the University at Buffalo. The University at Buffalo is evolving AI technologies with the goal of solving some of society's most pressing challenges. More at buffalo.edu/AI. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Asma Khalid. Last week, Princeton joined the growing list of Ivy League schools facing cuts to federal funding under the Trump administration. The move comes after the White House pulled funding from Harvard and Columbia after it determined the schools failed to combat anti-Semitism. The Trump administration also suspended funds to the University of Pennsylvania after it allowed a transgender athlete on the women's swim team. For more, we called up the president of Princeton University, Christopher Eisgruber.
Well, pleasure to be here.
So you have called the Trump administration's funding freeze of funds to Columbia the first, now I should point out, of several universities that have been targeted, and the first, we should point out, also to have made some concessions. But you have called those threats to federal funds the greatest threat to American universities since the Red Scare. That sounds awfully ominous. Why so?
Yeah, so Asma, I think there are two aspects of the threats that universities are facing right now that lead me to the conclusion that you just described. One is that this compact between the government and universities, where the government has, ever since World War II, asked universities to perform research on behalf of the American people that the government funds, has been really important to America's preeminence in science and engineering. It has made the country stronger, and it has made our universities the best in the world. But even more fundamental than that, especially with regard to what happened at Columbia, is a threat to academic freedom. And I say that about Columbia in particular because what happened there was that the government threatened to withdraw funding from things like medical science and biomedical research unless Columbia changed what it was doing with regard to things like admissions or utterly unrelated departments that studied, for example, the Middle East. Mm-hmm. That's a threat to academic freedom. And if the government starts using the clout it gets from the funding it provides to sciences and engineering to invade that academic freedom, it will compromise things that are fundamental to the excellence of American universities and that are really integral to the pursuit of knowledge and the strength of our society.
So you first spoke up about what was going on at Columbia before Princeton had real dollars on the line. And now we have seen Columbia's concessions. You mentioned the Middle East Studies Department. It is now, the Columbia has agreed to be putting that under an administration overseer. Does it make it more difficult for you now to navigate the stand and say, no, we're not going to make concessions because we are looking at other universities willing to make some concessions?
We make our decisions at Princeton based on our values and our principles. You know, I don't want to pass judgment on what other universities do. These are extraordinarily difficult circumstances. But we're going to stand strong for our values at Princeton, and I think we have a community that is united behind those values.
So you're not willing at this point to make any concessions?
We believe it's important to defend academic freedom, and that's not something that can be compromised.
What impact will these potential cuts have to the research that goes on at the university? What, for example, were you all doing with these federal funds?
So a lot of these federal funds that were affected have to do with things that are actually priorities not only for Princeton University, but for the American government and indeed for this administration. So some of these grants have to do with things like machine learning, they have to do with quantum science, they have to do with fusion, and those are all identified priorities of the U.S. government and of the current administration in Washington. With regard to Princeton and with regard to other universities, as I said earlier, the reason that we have been able to be leaders on research that benefits the American people and makes this country stronger, more secure, and healthier is because of this extraordinary partnership that the United States have developed over time between its government and its universities. If that partnership gets interrupted, if we can't pursue these particular grants on these subjects, it's going to diminish the kind of research that we can do that makes a difference in terms of these priorities that universities and the government have identified as urgent. It also, Asma, creates a lot of uncertainty that is itself a problem. So if you think about young people, whether they're undergraduates or graduate students, thinking of pursuing careers in these research areas that are fundamental, they're making decisions that depend upon knowing that the support is going to be there that enables them to do that work, to get the graduate stipends that they need, and to pursue research careers that depend upon the availability of this kind of funding. So one of the things that I'm especially worried about is a disruption of that talent pipeline that has been so important to the United States' leadership in the world.
Have you gotten any clarity from the Trump administration about what they would like for Princeton to do? Do they want to have you change anything specifically?
At this point, we haven't gotten any instructions to change anything, right? So, and again, when I talked about what happened at Columbia, one of the reasons that it made it such a fundamental threat to academic freedom was that the government effectively said, in order to get these funds back, you have to do these other things, which were inconsistent with the respect for academic freedom. We have not received any communication from the government that explains why these grants were suspended or request to do anything in response to the suspensions.
Mr. Heisgruber, I think a lot of folks would presume that Ivy League universities have large endowments that they could tap into more readily than, say, public universities. Can you weather these cuts? And why not tap into these endowments?
So first of all, I appreciate the question because I think it's really important for folks to understand how it is that endowments work. Princeton and other universities that have endowments spend them at over 5% a year. So we have to spend 5% a year from an endowment, whether the markets are good or whether they're bad. And we do that in order to help pay for substantial portions of the cost of research in addition to what the government sponsors. We do that in order to pay our faculty. We do that in order to make our education affordable to students. At Princeton, for example, we have 71% of our students on financial aid, and our students graduate, most of them, with zero debt, and the rest of them with the lowest debt in the nation. That's because we're tapping into our endowment all the time. The endowment can help us to respond to, say, very short-term suspensions in research funding. But if you get to longer-term deprivation of grants at Princeton or elsewhere, what it's going to mean is that there are going to have to be choices to stop doing things that we're doing now, such as either research that is fundamental to addressing critical problems, not only in the sciences and engineering, but across the fields at the university, or measures that we're taking in order to make sure that the university is affordable and accessible to students from all backgrounds.
What might it mean for you all at Princeton to potentially stand alone? Because we don't hear a widespread chorus from other universities in this moment echoing the message that you are delivering, or at least publicly, we are not hearing it.
Well, so let me say, first of all, we are starting to see some statements from other universities. The board of the Association of American Universities, which I chair, put out a statement earlier this week reaffirming its support for academic freedom and noting the threats that result from the withdrawal of government funding to universities. I think other university presidents, I hope, will be speaking out in the future. But Asma, I make the decisions for one university, and what I can say is that whether or not we have to stand alone in terms of when we're speaking out, it's essential that I speak out on behalf of this and that we stand up for these principles. I think those principles, I should say, though, they are widely shared at other universities. I think there is growing recognition of the need to stand firmly for them, and I expect there will be other presidents and other universities that are doing so alongside us.
Christopher Eisgruber is the president of Princeton University. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Asma.
On Tuesday night at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., playwright Larissa Fasthorse was adding the final touches to her latest production.
New lines, friends. Winona, River, let's work out cat custody details. Mark, that's the fake River?
Her show is called Fake It Until You Make It. It's a comedy that follows the intensifying rivalry between the heads of two nonprofits, Winona, the Native American head of No Bush, and River, the white leader of a group called Indigenous Nation Soaring.
I'm simply asking for you to help me take out one white woman, just one. Not to kill her, but to help me get her endless privilege so that I don't lose my mind.
The show leans into farce, complete with mistaken identities.
Oh no! Federal agents! I can explain!
There is no explaining. You just disappear.
And slamming doors.
Wait! Hang the door!
And though the form may be classic, the style is proudly Indigenous, from the vibrant set to the music used to transition between scenes.
We are not just indigenizing the ideas on the stage and the actors, but that the whole space feels like you're entering a different world, which is my world.
I spoke with Larissa Fasthorse the morning after we sat in on rehearsals. She told me working in the nonprofit world inspired the play.
Indigenous serving organizations run by Indigenous and non-Indigenous people are afforded very different levels of funding, very different levels of trust, very different levels of access. And seeing that in real life made me say, ooh, that's actually really natural for farce in the way that it gets really kind of ridiculous.
You mentioned this word farce.
Mm-hmm.
You were keen to make this play a farce. What does that mean in the world of theater?
For me, I think what's exciting about it and what's been fun about learning the form is that it lets you heighten everything. Okay. So everything can be a little ridiculous, a little more. And so it makes it easier to have the kind of social commentary that I like to include with my comedy and with the laughs. You know, for me, it's very important that you laugh and you have a good time at the theater, but then you also think a little bit. And farce is really made for that. And I did a lot of research through a lot of older plays. And it was so interesting to see how certain parts of the genre, like any genre piece, right, haven't changed. You know, a door is a door. And, and opening a door and slamming a door, all those things are still funny, but they also are obvious social commentary, right? And they lend themselves immediately to metaphor and to symbolism and to the ways that, you know, we look at who gets to go through those doors and who gets to open them and who doesn't.
You know, this play is a satire. It was funny. And I will say in the rehearsal we saw, there were moments when I was laughing out loud. But I also feel like underneath you are exploring these heavy ideas about Native American identity and race shifting. What did you want to work through or say about these ideas?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think the idea of Indigenous identity has been incredibly complicated for us Native people for a very long time, since, you know, America's colonized this area. We're political systems, right? So we're independent sovereign nations existing within the United States. I'm a dual citizen of the United States and of the Sichangu Lakota Nation. And I think most folks in this country haven't fully understood that and are only starting to, because it's both, it can be a race, it can be a culture, but it's also political. And it's inherently political because we are independent nations. So trying to explore that in theater can get very heady and boring and weird and dull. And I think, you know, using this format of satire and farce to explore it, one, just makes it fun, makes it palatable, makes it interesting, but also does allow me to open up the absurdity of what we're dealing with, right? Because we are independent nations within this larger nation. And it is an absurd thing.
So this is the second stop for your play. It debuted in California, and you are now coming to Washington. at a moment when there are so many political debates in this town about reshaping culture. President Trump has tried to take control of certain cultural institutions and wants to eliminate what his administration sees as woke ideology. I've got to ask, how does it feel to bring this show, your show, to D.C. at this particular moment?
Yeah, I mean, we were really excited to come to D.C. right now. I mean, because it's a show about, you know, identity. It's a show about race. It's a show about politics. It's a show about Native American representation. It's also a show about Two-Spirit representation, which is very important to us to have.
Two-Spirit, what does that mean?
It means that you are in possession of multiple spirits that are related to perhaps sexual orientation and gender.
Okay.
It's interesting because living in Los Angeles, where we started this show, it can feel a little echo chambery. And it's been really exciting actually to be in DC, where just walking around the streets these few days, I've run into people with so many different ways of looking at the world. And to me, that's the best thing theater can do, right? Is create a welcoming space where people can come, they can have fun, they can laugh, they can enjoy their neighbor that may think differently than them, that may laugh at different things than them, and start to think about that and wonder why. You know, as a playwright, I always say it's not important to me that you agree with me. Like, that to me is not interesting. What's interesting is to create plays and pieces of art that first are fun and first get you out there with humanity, and then second, make you have to wonder why you think things or why you agree and disagree with things, as opposed to just agreeing or disagreeing with what I say. I leave a lot of questions open.
You know, a number of characters in this play are written as Native people. So I am curious what happens with this play after DC then.
Yeah, I mean, my hope, people will continue to do it. You know, other folks have been a little more successful than I have as in getting larger Native cast plays. I think of Mary Catherine Nagel, who has been at Arena Stage before me. For some reason, I seem to really struggle with getting people to do that. We do have four Native actors in this show. I would be unbelievably thrilled to have this show be on Broadway with all these, this incredible Native cast. I don't know if we've ever seen any Broadway play with this many Native actors. That would be really incredible, an amazing milestone to cross.
Larissa Fasthorse, her new play, Fake It Until You Make It, is at Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, it's been really fun. Thanks.
Been listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Lummelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lummelson.org. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
Shorty George and me, just feel some jive, we'll dig you out, you see.
Well, Henri,
are you ready?
Yes, we're ready, Joe.
Jump in steady, Joe. You look solid, Joe. All I want to know, are you Henri?
Yes, we're Henri.
You can get it.
Can we get it?
If you said it,
yeah, we said it, Joe.
Come on, let me go. All I want to know, are you all right?
Yes, we're all right. tree. I'm like a tree, I'm all root. Hep to the jep, what it's all about. Stash like a top.